Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. It's Mother's Day weekend. Time to pause from busy schedules and remember, honor, and celebrate Mom. We're in very good company here. So many have mused poetic about their mothers. For example, Honest Abe, All That I Am or Hope to Be, I Owe to My Angel Mother. To Napoleon, Let France Have Good Mothers and She Will Have Good Sons. Our Mother's Day salute spotlights moms who've strayed a bit out of the mold. Parenting titles that look at issues in new ways, and books that find humor in the trials and tribulations of everyday parenting. We'll even preview some fiction titles your mom might love. You may find some inspiration among today's titles. Let's begin as we turn to page one of the book report. The book report begins this Mother's Day salute with a look at a celebrity who's also made her mark as a mom. Much has happened to Gabrielle Reese since her 1997 bestseller, Big Girl in the Middle. The pro volleyball player, sports announcer, fashion model, and actress is still gorgeous, still 6'3", and is still a dominant force on and off the beach. But as we learn in My Foot is Too Big for the Glass Slipper, written with Karen Carbo, in the last 15 years, Gabrielle settled down with world-class surfer Laird Hamilton and raised three girls. Her life might seem like a fairy tale, but 4 years after her marriage to Laird, Gabrielle filed for divorce. In the end, though, the couple worked it out. The book is an unvarnished and often hilarious tale of the turbulent ups and downs that beset every wife and mother, even women like Gabrielle, who seem to have it all. Reese, who narrates, writes with wicked humor and down-to-earth wit about how she handles the sometimes mind-numbing details of domestic life. Can women have it all? See what Gabrielle has to say.
My happily ever after began on November 30th, 1997. On that day, I married my prince in the middle of the gently winding Hanalei River on the north shore of the Garden Island of Kauai. Ever resourceful, my prince lashed together a pair of canoes and affixed a platform on top of them, then decorated it with purple orchids, tuberose, and plumeria. During the only sunbreak of the day, we exchanged vows. My prince was bare-chested and wore a pareo, a wraparound skirt traditional for men of the Pacific Islands. He looked even more studly than usual. I wore a white Calvin Klein bikini beneath a sheer white Donna Karan dress. I might as well just confirm what you're already thinking. I looked completely fabulous. What you don't know, of course, is that I was a hot mess only an hour before, madly doing laundry and scrubbing the bathroom for our out-of-town visitors. After the ceremony, we repaired with our dozen guests, close friends all, to Hanalei Bay, where we had a champagne picnic. It was the perfect ending to the fairy tale courtship that had begun 2 years ago that very day. Naturally, 4 years later, I filed for divorce. My childhood was rough enough to knock the belief in happily ever after clean out of my heart. My parents split when I was too young to remember. Then, when I was 5, my dad died in a plane crash. I've always been one of those hard-headed chicks who believe that we're all responsible for our own happiness. Still, when I married Laird, I was confident I'd found my soulmate. Who could be more perfect for me than a guy who was my height? Laird and I met in 1995 while I was shooting a TV show called The Extremist. Like pretty much everything else these days, you can find it online. I was 25 and wore an oversized white t-shirt. My hair, are those bangs? Is whipping around in the wind. The sky behind me is angry with bruise-colored clouds. Today, I'm hanging with an extremist who catches some serious waves, I say. His name is Laird Hamilton, and he lives for the big swell. I ask him whether he considers this to be a big swell day, and even though it looks as if a hurricane is about to roll in at any second, he says no. Laird looked exactly the same way he looks right this minute, tan and focused. You can see us falling in love right there on camera. 10 days later, we moved in together. We didn't even make it to our 5th anniversary before our sexy fairy tale turned into one of those unwatchable Swedish domestic dramas that makes the audience want to throw themselves off the nearest bridge. We were so simpatico in so many ways, but stupidly, we counted on this fact to remain immutable and provide us an unshakable foundation for our relationship.
That was My Foot is Too Big for the Glass Slipper by Gabrielle Reese with Karen Carbo. Readers, this book is from 2012, but it's still a title worth considering for Mother's Day gifting. In Please Look After Mom, Kyung Suk Shin delivers a stark, beautiful book about the loss of a mother and the complexity of family relationships, all set against the backdrop of a rapidly modernizing South Korea. Her simple, moving prose is presented elegantly, with just a touch of magical realism. When their elderly mother accidentally disappears into the crowded streets of Seoul, the family bands together to track her down. Her country upbringing, illiteracy, and mild dementia don't make that task easy. And for most of the novel, we are left crossing our fingers, hoping that the flyers, newspaper ads, and occasional tips will return her safe and sound. As her children argue over how to find her, and her husband returns to their countryside home to wait for her, they each recall their lives with her. Their memories are often more surprising than comforting. Have they lived up to her expectations? Was she happy? Through the piercing voices of daughter, son, and husband, and through mom's own words in the novel's shattering conclusion, we learn what happened that day and explore an even deeper mystery, that of motherhood itself. An ensemble cast performs the book.
When she heard that onions were good for one's health, she made onion juice. And before winter came, she made pumpkin juice infused with licorice. Your mom's house was like a factory. She prepared sauces and fermented bean paste and hulled rice, producing things for the family year-round. At some point, the children's trips to Jongup became less frequent, and mom and father started to come to Seoul more often. And then you began to celebrate each of their birthdays by going out for dinner. That was easier. Then mom even suggested, "Let's celebrate my birthday on your father's." She said it would be a burden to celebrate their birthdays separately, since both happened during the hot summer, when there are also two ancestral rites only 2 days apart. At first, the family refused to do that, even when Mom insisted on it, and if she balked at coming to the city, a few of you went home to celebrate with her. Then you all started to give Mom her birthday gift on Father's birthday. Eventually, quietly, Mom's actual birthday was bypassed. Mom, who liked to buy socks for everyone in the family, had in her dresser a growing collection of socks that her children didn't take. Name, Park Sonyo. Date of birth, July 24th, 1938, 69 years old. Appearance, short, salt-and-pepper permed hair, prominent cheekbones, last seen wearing a sky blue shirt, a white jacket, and a beige pleated skirt. Last seen, Seoul Station subway. Nobody can decide which picture of Mom you should use. Everyone agrees it should be the most recent picture, but nobody has a recent picture of her. You remember that at some point, Mom started to hate getting her picture taken. She would sneak away even for family portraits. The most recent photograph of Mom is a family picture taken at Father's 70th birthday party. Mom looked nice in a pale blue hanbok, with her hair done at a salon, and she was even wearing red lipstick. Your younger brother thinks your mom looks so different in this picture from the way she did right before she went missing. He doesn't think people would identify her as the same person, even if her image is isolated and enlarged. He reports that when he posted this picture of her, people responded by saying, "Your mother is pretty, and she doesn't seem like the kind of person who would get lost." You all decide to see if anyone has another picture of Mom. Hyungchul tells you to write something more on the flyer. When you stare at him, he tells you to think of better sentences, to tug on the reader's heartstrings. Words that would tug on the reader's heartstrings? When you write, "Please help us find our mother," He says it's too plain. When you write, "Our mother is missing," he says that "mother" is too formal and tells you to write "mom." When you write, "Our mom is missing," he decides it's too childish. When you write, "Please contact us if you see this person," he barks, "What kind of writer are you?" You can't think of a single sentence that would satisfy Hyeongchul. Your second eldest brother says, "You'd tug on people's heartstrings if you write that there will be a reward." When you write, "We will reward you generously," your sister-in-law says you can't write like that. People take notice only if you write a specific amount. So how much should I say? 1,000,000 won? That's not enough. 3,000,000 won? I think that's too little, too. Then 5,000,000 won. Nobody complains about 5,000,000 won. You write, "We will reward you with 5,000,000 won, and put in a period. Your second eldest brother says you should write it as, "Reward, 5,000,000 won. Your younger brother tells you to put 5,000,000 won in a bigger font. Everyone agrees to email you a better picture of Mom if they find something.
We've just heard "Please Look After Mom" by Kyung Suk Shin. Clement Hurd was born in New York City in 1908. He graduated from Yale in 1930, then left for Paris. He studied painting there in the studio of Fernand Léger. The Depression brought him back to New York, and he began to work as a freelance artist. The children's author, Margaret Weiss Brown, first saw his work at a house in Greenwich, Connecticut, where he'd painted a humorous mural for a bathhouse. Margaret believed his style was well-suited to children's books, and the rest is history. Hurd and Brown's collaboration lasted for many years and included what my kids and I consider to be the most beloved children's book of all times, Goodnight Moon, followed closely by The Runaway Bunny. Over a long and illustrious career, Clement illustrated more than 100 books, many of them done with his wife, Edith Thatcher Hurd. A standout of his career was his work with Gertrude Stein, who wrote the children's book The World is Round. Today, to commemorate the 75th anniversary of that book's publication, we'll speak with Hurd's son, Thatcher. Welcome, Thatcher, and thanks so much for joining us on the Book Report today.
My pleasure.
How did your father become involved in the project The World is Round?
Well, he had studied painting in Paris for a couple of years, and when he came home to New York, he got involved in sort of a kind of revolution in children's books, which was partly led by Margaret Weiss Brown, who of course later did Goodnight Moon. And Margaret was an author at the time writing children's books, but she also was an editor at a tiny publishing company called Young Scott Books. And one day she had the idea in an editorial meeting, she said, "Why don't we write to some well-known authors and get them to write a children's book." And so he was one of the artists that they chose to, Ms. Stein said, everybody except Gertrude Stein, they asked Ernest Hemingway and they asked John Steinbeck and they asked Gertrude Stein to do a children's book. And the only one who said yes was Gertrude Stein, and she said, "Yes, I'd love to do a children's book. In fact, I've already written most of it." So when they got this book from her, they were fascinated with it. It was a really unusual book, and she had an artist who she wanted to illustrate it named Francis Rose, but nobody was real too crazy about him. So they said to her, "Well, you can choose the artist. We'll send you some artwork from various artists, and you can choose." And my father was one of those artists. And that was kind of how he got involved in it.
And can you tell us a little bit of the story of The World is Round?
Well, it's a story of a girl named Rose and her journey up a mountain. lot, but it has gorgeous language, and it's beautifully written. It's a story of Rose and her cousin Willie, and it's mainly for the language of it. I could read some of it.
All right, please do.
Okay, this is the beginning. Once upon a time, the world was round, and you could go on it around and around. Everywhere there was somewhere, and everywhere there, they were men, women, children, dogs, cows, wild pigs, little rabbits, cats, lizards, and animals. That is the way it was. And everybody, dogs, cats, sheep, rabbits, lizards, and children, all wanted to tell everybody all about it. And they wanted to tell all about themselves. And then there was Rose. Rose was her name, and would she have been Rose if her name had not been Rose? She used to think, and then she used to think again. Would she have been Rose if her name had not been Rose? And would she have been Rose if she had been a twin? Rose was her name all the same, and her father's name was Bob, and her mother's name was Kate, and her uncle's name was William, and her aunt's name was Gloria, and her grandmother's name was Lucy. They all had names, and her name was Rose. But would she have been, she used to cry about it, would she have been Rose if her name had not been Rose? I tell you, at this time, the world was all round and you could go on it around and around.
You know, reviewers say that the book was meant to be read aloud, and I have to admit, I agree after hearing you read it.
Yes. It when you look at it on the page, it has very little punctuation. It looks very flat. But when you read it aloud, like if a group of people got together or two people read it to each other, it starts to suddenly come alive and you realize there's a lot of humor in it, there's a lot of emotion in it, there's a lot of beautiful rhythm in it.
Right. Now, Gertrude insisted on pink for the book's page color. Why was that?
Well, I think she would have called it Rose.
All right.
Because she, of course, she was famous already. She was, you know, a well-known author, and she had come up with this, a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose, and in this book, the little girl is named Rose, and it's based on a real girl that Gertrude knew in France named Rose, and so she wanted the paper to be rose-colored, and blue was Rose's favorite color, so she wanted the type to be blue. And she also wanted to have the illustrator I was talking about earlier, who she wanted to have, was named Francis Rose.
Did your father ever meet Gertrude Stein?
No, sadly he didn't. They had a very warm correspondence, and she was very supportive of his art and really liked his art very much. And she was planning to come in 1940 and do a lecture tour around the United States. And they were planning to get together, but then, of course, the war came along, and that never happened.
Right.
And she died in 1946.
Well, let's talk a moment about Goodnight Moon. How long after it was published did it become evident to your father that it would become and remain a classic?
It was quite a while. I remember that Goodnight Moon almost went out of print years after it was published in 1947, in the early 50s. And then late in the 1950s, it just started to sell more copies every year. And, you know, just a few thousand every year. And then slowly through the 60s and the 70s, just organically, it started to sell more and more. And I remember him in the 1970s, when he came to visit at our house, he would, every 6 months, he'd get royalty statements from the publisher. And he would write down the figures on this little piece of paper. And he would come and he would say, look at this batch. Can you believe? Look at how much Goodnight Moon is selling. So he, towards the end of his life, he really got a sense that this book was something special and that it was really growing and was going to be sort of a permanent, you know, classic of children's books. Margaret apparently dreamed Goodnight Moon. It was an idea that came to her in a dream, and she wrote it down in the morning. And later, a little while later, she connected my father with it, and she wanted him to illustrate it. And they went to their editor, who was the famous editor Ursula Nordstrom at Harper in New York, and they said, we have a Goodnight book, and it's But the illustrations, it's all going to be the same picture, just getting a little darker on each page. And the editor, Ursula Nordstrom, was kind of taken aback by this. But then as soon as she saw the book and realized what a powerful kind of imagery and rhythm it was to it, she was totally enthusiastic.
Hmm. Okay.
The book didn't sell well for a long time. It took a long time to become Goodnight Moon.
Are you an artist?
Yeah, I write and illustrate kids' books myself. I do sort of a completely different kind of book. I write and illustrate picture books. Probably the best-known one is called Art Dog. And I did a book called Mama Don't Allow and a book called Mystery on the Docks.
Now, do you have a website where listeners can see your work?
Yes, it's thatcherherd.com.
All right.
T-H-A-C-H-E-R-H-U-R-D, no middle T.
All right. Well, Thatcher, any final thoughts?
No, I just hope people will go out and check out these gorgeous pink pages and this beautiful writing in The World is Round.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I know I enjoyed the book, but I really enjoyed it when you read it. Thank you.
Thank you.
All
My
right.
pleasure.
All right. Bye. Book Report promised diversity in titles. So here is what we describe as the contrarian title for Mother's Day. I Can Barely Take Care of Myself, Tales from a Happy Life Without Kids. You'll Change Your Mind. That's what everyone said to comedian Jen Kirkman and countless women like her when she confesses she doesn't plan to have kids. But Jen believes it's hard enough to be an adult. You have to dress yourself, pay bills, remember to buy birthday gifts. You have to drive and get annual physicals. Some adults take on the added burden of caring for a tiny human being with no language skills or bladder control. Parenthood can be very rewarding, but as Jen points out, so are margaritas at the adults-only pool. Jen's stand-up routine includes jokes about not having kids, after which complete strangers constantly approach her and ask, "But who will take care of you when you're old?" "Servants," she exclaims. Jen, who narrates, is a beacon of hilarious hope for anyone whose major life decisions have been questioned by friends, family, and strangers.
After graduating from Boston's Emerson College in June 1996 with a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Theater Arts, I moved back into my parents' house. There are few to no well-paying jobs available to a girl who minored in rolling around on the floor collecting dust bunnies on her sweatpants, otherwise known as modern dance. I wish I'd had a really good reason for moving back home, like my friend Jason from freshman year in college. It was rumored that Jason took too much acid and also became possessed by the devil on the same night. This rumor started because he dropped two tabs while doing a seance around a pentagram that Mick, his practicing Satanist roommate, had burned into their dorm room rug. After the devil possessed him and or the bad trip never wore off, folklore has it that Jason was forever unable to speak but couldn't stop laughing, like some kind of demonic hyena. Jason left school during his first semester and moved into his mom's basement, where he sat staring at the wall and listening to Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon most of the day, except for the time he spent at his part-time job at his hometown library. I know that story sounds implausible. What library would employ a loud laugher? Anyway, I didn't have an excuse for moving back home that I could pin on my mom and dad either, such as, it turned out that my mom wasn't a hypochondriac and she actually did have a fatal heart murmur, and it was her dying wish for me to move back into my childhood bedroom that was still covered with floral psychedelic wallpaper from the 1970s. That would have been a good one, except for the fatal heart murmur part. It's not like I hadn't made plans for my post-college life. I had. My plan was to become a famous television actress. The type who could play younger, because as a 21-year-old, I still looked 16, just like everyone on Beverly Hills 90210. Well, except for Andrea. Also a realist, I also had a backup plan, and that was to become a famous actress on Broadway. I'd certainly put in some semi-quality time training to be an actress. I spent every morning in acting class putting my hand on my solar plexus to find my emotion and then breathing from my diaphragm. I usually found only a cough when I breathed deeply from my diaphragm because I'd developed a pack-a-day habit of smoking Camel Lights. I inhaled the acting class air like a young, hopeful girl, then hacked and wheezed out phlegm like a longshoreman whose emphysema gets exacerbated by his seasonal pneumonia. I was convinced that simply because I attended college and majored in acting, I would walk out of the not a serious acting conservatory Emerson College and straight into my own trailer in Hollywood or some backstage door on 42nd Street. The details were not mine to work out. That's what acting professors were for. This was before I realized that my acting professors were themselves actors who also thought at one point in their misguided youth that they'd be famous. I don't think any of them ever got offered a role in The Godfather and told Coppola, "Thanks for thinking of me, but I'm going to have to turn this role down. My real passion is to wake up every morning and teach a bunch of hungover college kids the concept of sense memory." In all my years of college, I never really sat down and got to thinking, okay, so how do I take this class where I do monologues from Equus and turn it into a career? I was usually busy thinking about the cute Kurt Cobain lookalike who was always sitting alone in the cafeteria near the cereal. Turns out that the reason he looked so much like Kurt Cobain was that he was also a heroin addict. I recently looked him up on Facebook, and now he's a chubby, short-haired, button-up, shirt-wearing computer programmer, married with two kids. I mourn this outcome more than if he had OD'd. In the back of my mind, I just assumed that there existed a special red phone in the dean's office at Emerson. In my limited knowledge of how the world actually worked, I decided that this phone I made up in my head existed solely for placing and receiving calls to and from Hollywood. I pictured a kingmaker with a Santa Claus-esque workshop running Hollywood, who kept a master list. Instead of who's naughty and who's nice, his list had names of who's talented and who's not. I pictured my acting teacher calling this Hollywood Santa and saying something like, "Hi, this is Judith Renner. I'd like to report that Jen Kirkman just made herself cry in my acting 101 class. Yes, she was doing a monologue about being a single mother, but she used the image of her favorite dead pet as a catalyst for the tears. She was also speaking from her diaphragm and not mumbling. Oh, and she also nailed this really difficult Fosse dance move that involves crooking her pinky finger and sitting on a chair. Can we move her up on the talented list? Great. We'll be in touch once she nails a Scottish accent, specifically the Shetland Isles."
That was I Can Barely Take Care of Myself by Jen Kirkman. Red Joan by Jenny Rooney is the story of Joan Stanley, a loving mother, a doting grandmother. Joan leads a quiet, unremarkable life in the suburbs, until one morning there's a knock on the door. Suddenly, the past Joan has hidden for 50 years threatens to overturn her world. Cambridge University in 1937 was awash with ideas and idealists. Yet, unworldly Joan felt better suited to a science lecture. But a chance meeting with the glamorous Russian-born Sonia and her charismatic cousin Leo blurred the edges of things Joan thought she knew about the world and herself. In the post-war world of smoke and mirrors, allegiance was a slippery thing. Working in a government ministry with access to top-secret information, Joan was faced with the most difficult question of all. What price would you pay to remain true to what you believe? Would you betray your country or the man you love? Juliet Stevenson performs the book.
The obituary is accompanied by a picture of William as a young man, his features clear and unblemished, just as he was the last time she saw him. His eyes are directed straight at the camera, a slight smile playing on his lips, as if he knows something he shouldn't. She imagines that, to the rest of the world, the mistiness of the black-and-white image might appear glamorous and full of pathos, a picture of youth in a bygone age. But to Joan, it is like looking at a ghost. They come for her later that morning. Joan is watching from her bedroom window as a long black car turns into the quiet suburban street of pebble-thatched terraces where she has lived ever since moving back to England from Australia after her husband's death 15 years earlier. The car is out of place in this part of southeast London. She observes the man and woman as they step out and glance about them, absorbing their surroundings. The woman is wearing high heels and a smart camel-coloured Macintosh, and the man is carrying a briefcase. They stand next to each other, conferring, facing across the road towards her house. Goosebumps rise on her arms and neck. For some reason, she had always thought they would come for her at night. She did not imagine a day like this, cold and bright and perfectly still. She watches as they cross the road and push open her front gate. Perhaps she's being paranoid. They could be anyone, social workers or Meals on Wheels salespeople. She has sent such people away before. The knock is loud and staccato. Official sounding.
Open up! Security services.
She steps back quickly, her heart stuttering as she lets the curtain fall in front of her. Too old to run. She wonders what they would do if she does not answer the door. Would they break it down? Or just trust that she's not in and come back again tomorrow? She could stay here until they've gone, and then she could... She stops. Could what? Where could she go for any length of time without arousing suspicion? And what would she say to her son about where she was? Another knock, louder this time. Joan clasps her hands across her stomach as the thought occurs to her that they might try to find her at her son's house if they do not find her here. Her neck feels hot at the prospect of one of Nick's boys answering the door, muddy-haired and careless in his football kit, calling out that some people have come about Granny. If Nick saw these two, in their smart clothes and black car, he would think they had come to inform him of his mother's death. And Joan feels a stab of guilt to imagine his shock at this news. And then a greater, more terrible shock, as he learns that, no, this is not what they've come to tell him. And which of those would be worse? It is a tickling, stealthy creep of a thought, so bold and yet so soft as it insinuates itself in her mind, and she feels a cold spasm of fear run its sharp finger down her back. Yes, she can see why William might have thought it better to kill himself. She could do it right now, take the St. Christopher's medal from her bedside drawer and push it open to reveal the needle tip. And then she could settle herself into bed one last time, and she would never have to face them. It would be over. Finished. And when they found her, she would appear just as peaceful as William had. Just as innocent. How easy it would be. But easier for whom? For one thing, the presence of curare in her bloodstream might now be traceable, even if it had not been 60 years ago, and would be revealed by an autopsy. Or it might not work. It might be too old. It might only half work.
We've just heard Red Joan by Jenny Rooney. In a culture that idealizes motherhood, it's scary to confess that in your house, being a mother is beautiful, dirty, joyful, and frustrating all at once. Admitting that it's not easy doesn't make you a bad mom. At least it shouldn't. When Jill Smokler was first home with her small children, she began a blog to keep friends and family updated. To her surprise, she hit a chord in the hearts of mothers everywhere. Total strangers started contributing their views on that strange reality called motherhood. As other women shared their stories, Jill realized she wasn't alone in her feelings of exhaustion and imperfection. But she sensed her readers were still holding back, so she decided to start an anonymous confessional, a place where real moms could leave their most honest thoughts without fearing condemnation. The reactions were amazing, some sad, some hysterically funny, some brutally honest. The book report is sure you'll be completely entertained by Confessions of a Scary Mommy, an honest and irreverent look at motherhood, the good, the bad, and the scary. The collection, narrated by the author, combines new essays plus some of the best of the anonymous confessions.
Mommy Confessions.
I confess that most days, I feel like I have no idea what I'm doing. Everyone thinks I have it all together. Good wife, good mom, successful career. But I really don't. I'm ready to stop pretending to be perfect now.
I tried for 7 years to get pregnant, and now that I'm a mother, I wonder whether it was all worth it.
If I have to watch Barney one more time, I may have to stick a fork in my eye. Actually, then I'd get some attention. Maybe not such a bad idea.
I sometimes try to get sick, just so I have an excuse to go to sleep at 6 p.m.
I joined a gym just for the free daycare. I drop the kids off and read magazines and blogs in the locker room.
I pretend to be happy being a stay-at-home mom, but sometimes I feel like I'm slowly dying. I cry every night in the shower. This isn't what I thought it would be.
I kiss my young teenager goodbye in the morning as she leaves for school, rising above the hormone-fueled snarling and histrionics. Then I close the front door and flip her off with both hands.
I miss the career I gave up more than I miss my son when I go to the grocery store. But I always get to go back to him.
Hidden in the pantry in a box labeled flour is top-of-the-line chocolate and a few joints. I rarely resort to it, but it's a comfort knowing it's there.
There are a million ironies in motherhood. The day you decide to change the sheets will inevitably be the night your child wets the bed. With a million toys in the house, your baby will without a doubt prefer to play with pots and pans from the kitchen cabinet than with any expensive learning game. And your kids will always fall asleep early for the sitter who gets paid by the hour to entertain them. It's unfair, uncool, and unjust, but unfortunately, it's just the way it is. Perhaps, though, the biggest irony out there is that despite never actually being alone, can you remember the last time you actually peed in peace? As a mother, you can feel totally isolated. A few years ago, I was a stay-at-home mom to 3 kids, ranging in age from a newborn to a 4-year-old. I was living in a new house in a new town among unfamiliar neighbors. It was lonely and overwhelming, and I was bordering on miserable. A fellow mom from down the street stopped by our house to introduce herself and ask how my days were going. Half-jokingly, I responded, "The baby is a bit of an but he'll grow out of it. We'll survive." The look on her face was enough to let me know that not only had I offended her, but we would not be spending our afternoons commiserating together. She had 3 young kids as well. Was she not slowly going insane too? Did she not long for an afternoon without the kids wiping snot on her jeans and a baby spitting up constantly? Did she not lock herself in a bathroom, ignoring the whining on the other side of the door? Apparently not. Or she faked it a hell of a lot better than I was able to. We like to paint motherhood as a picture-perfect experience, filled with idyllic children and beaming mothers. A perfect newborn peacefully resting on his mother's chest. A toddler taking tentative first steps into the loving arms of his mother, who is smiling proudly and wiping tears of joy from her cheeks. A mother's long blonde hair trailing in the wind as she holds hands with and runs alongside her beautiful, impeccably dressed children. A mother and daughter sipping tea and painting each other's nails, telling each other their deepest secrets and dreams. A mother leading Girl Scout troops and chairing PTA events and fluffing her daughter's prom dress before her nervous date knocks on the front door. Those moments of motherhood are indeed miraculous and joyful. They can also be few and far between. What if that baby never latches properly and breastfeeding becomes a nightmare that results in both baby and mother sobbing for hours on end? What if instead of happily reading together with her child for hours, the mother of a toddler wonders, just for an instant, whether there's something more to life than puzzles and ABCs?
We've just heard Confessions of a Scary Mommy by Jill Smokler. Thousands of books have examined the effects of parents on their children, but almost none have thought to ask, what are the effects of children on their parents? In All Joy and No Fun, award-winning journalist Jennifer Senior tackles this question, isolating and analyzing the many ways in which children reshape their parents' lives, their marriages, jobs, habits, hobbies, friendships, and their internal sense of self. Senior, who narrates, argues that changes in the last half century have radically altered the roles of today's moms and dads. Drawing from a wide variety of sources, history, sociology, economics, philosophy, psychology, and anthropology, she dissects both the timeless strains of parenting and the ones that are new, and then brings her research to life in the homes of ordinary parents. The result is an unforgettable series of family portraits, starting with parents of young children and progressing through parents of teens. Through lively and accessible storytelling, Senior follows these moms and dads as they wrestle with some of parenthood's deepest vexations and revel in some of its finest rewards.
In 1968, a sociologist named Alice Rossi published a paper that explored the abruptness of this transformation at great length. She called it simply Transition to Parenthood. She noted that when it comes to having a child, there is no equivalent of courtship, which one does before marriage, or job training, which one does before, say, becoming a nurse. The baby simply appears, quote, fragile and mysterious, and, quote, totally dependent. At the time, it was a radical observation. In Rossi's day, scholars were mainly concerned with the effect of parents on their children. What Rossi thought to do was swing the telescope around and ask this question from the reverse perspective. What was the effect of parenthood on adults? How did children affect their mothers' and fathers' lives? 45 years later, it's a question we're still trying to answer. I first started thinking about this question on the evening of January 3rd, 2008, when my son was born. But I didn't really explore it until more than 2 years later, when I wrote a story for New York Magazine that examined one of the more peculiar findings in the social sciences, that parents are no happier than non-parents, and in certain cases are considerably less happy. This conclusion violates some of our deepest intuitions, but it stretches back nearly 60 years, even predating Rossi's research. The first report came in 1957, a peak time for the veneration of the nuclear family. The paper was called Parenthood as Crisis, and in just 4 pages, the author managed to destroy the prevailing orthodoxy, declaring that babies weaken marriages rather than save them. He quoted a representative mother, "We knew where babies came from, but we didn't know what they were like." He then listed the complaints of the mothers he surveyed. Loss of sleep, especially during the early months, chronic tiredness or exhaustion, extensive confinement to the home and the resulting curtailment of their social contacts, giving up the satisfactions and the income of outside employment, additional washing and ironing, guilt at not being a quote-unquote better mother, the long hours and 7-day and night week necessary in caring for an infant, decline in their housekeeping standards, worry over their appearance, increased weight after pregnancy, etc. Fathers added more economic pressure, less sex, and, quote, general disenchantment with the parental role, end quote, to the brew. In 1975, another landmark paper showed that mothers presiding over an empty nest were not despairing, as conventional wisdom had always assumed, but happier than mothers who still had children at home. During the 80s, as women began their great rush into the workforce, sociologists generally concluded that while work was good for women's well-being, children tended to negate its positive effects. Throughout the next 2 decades, a more detailed picture emerged, with studies showing that children tended to compromise the psychological health of mothers more than fathers, and of single parents more than married parents. Meanwhile, psychologists and economists started to stumble across similar results, often when they weren't looking for them. In 2004, 5 researchers, including the Nobel Prize-winning behavioral economist Daniel Kahneman, did a study showing which activities gave 909 working women in Texas the most pleasure. Childcare ranked 16th out of 19, behind prepping food, behind watching TV, behind napping, behind shopping, behind housework. In an ongoing study, Matthew Killingsworth, a researcher at UC Berkeley and UC San Francisco, has found that children also rank low on the list of people whose company their parents enjoy.
That was All Joy and No Fun by Jennifer Senior. Nominated by the Audio Publishers Association for their 2013 Audi Humor Award, The Cursing Mommy's Book of Days is based on Ian Frazier's widely read columns for The New Yorker. the novel centers on a profoundly memorable character, the beleaguered wife of Larry and the mother of two boys, 12 and 9, trying, more or less, to offer tips on how to do various tasks around the home, only to end up on the ground, cursing, surrounded by broken glass. Actress Cynthia Nixon turns in a perfect performance as the hilariously desperate housewife with a taste for swearing and glasses of red wine. She eloquently speaks to the frustrations of everyday life.
January. Tuesday, January 4th. And so we set out. Ideally, this daybook would have started on Saturday morning, January 1st, but Larry and I had to be in Encino. A client of Larry's invites the whole office out there to stay over in his gigantic house for New Year's Eve and New Year's Day every year. This client brings in a huge amount of business, and Larry says we might be sleeping in the car if it weren't for him, so of course we have to go. And I do mean we, because the client is a big believer in wives attending, though they don't have much to do. Husbands, on the other hand, the client isn't so crazy about. That's another story. As a result, we weren't here for New Year's Day. We flew back on the 2nd, and on the 3rd, I drove to the assisted living to see my father. Tuesday, January 4th. I feel that I must start this day, month, and year over again. Just thinking about that weekend and then the trip to the horrible assisted living makes me want to put that nonsense far, far behind. I will clear my head, get a refill on my coffee, and go back to the kitchen table where I began. We must always remember to be grateful for what we have. On this winter morning, with the temperature in the 20s and snow covering the ground outside, I am grateful just to be sitting here, sheltered and indoors. My 8-year-old Kyle breaks out in hives and faints if you look at him cross-eyed, and he's probably doing exactly that right now in gym class. And any minute the phone will ring, and it will be the snotty assistant principal, and I will have to go out and hope the car will start so I can pick up my swooning son. But that hasn't happened yet. Who was it who called worry negative prayer? I will keep my hopes and prayers positive on this first day, 4th, technically, as I already explained, of our journey year. The children had such fun in the snow yesterday. I was at the assisted living. Larry was down in the basement doing something or other with his boxes of capacitors. And the kids had an absolute ball outside, he said. God knows he probably wasn't paying much attention. From where I sit, in my favorite kitchen chair, I can see the snowman they made. I am grateful for my children's happiness and the small monument to it remaining on our front lawn. Actually, as I look more closely at it, it's not so small. Moving to the front window, I wonder how they ever built a snowman that high. In fact, it doesn't really resemble a snowman. The reason it does not resemble a snowman, I now see, is that it is not a snowman. It is a snow penis.
We've just heard The Cursing Mommy's Book of Days by Ian Fraser. Listeners, we've covered some wonderfully diverse ground. In researching this show, I came across what is perhaps my favorite quote for Mother's Day. This one from Alice Walker, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Color Purple. She writes, "Yes, Mother, I can see you are flawed. You have not hidden it. That is your greatest gift to me." I hope your Mother's Day is very happy, however you choose to celebrate it. Thanks so much for joining me today, and let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.